Welcome to the MTFN Bizcast, a podcast designed to provide information regarding a variety of legal topics. The attorneys at Meisner, Tierney, Fisher & Nichols host new episodes every month covering topics that are current and relevant to business owners, professionals, and members of the legal community. Although we cannot provide legal advice that you can rely on in these episodes, we do hope that they will be helpful to you if and when you ever do need to seek professional advice.
Welcome back to the MTFM Bizcast and our monthly Up for Review segment, where we talk about what's going on in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I'm James Cisnoski.
And I'm Caleb Gerbitz. James, I can't help but notice you're coming through really clear.
Yeah, we got some new podcasting equipment, some real microphones and a preamp and all the other magical stuff that makes it sound better.
I'm entirely confused by everything going on here and know nothing about how any of this works, but...
Yeah, we just spent the better part of 45 minutes trying to get this all set up, but it seems to be working now.
Here's hoping it sounds better.
So Caleb and I are appellate litigators here at MTFN, and we've got a lot to cover in this segment, including the most expensive court election in United States history.
That's something like $47 million, I think, was the last number I saw.
Yeah, the total spending in... this Wisconsin Supreme Court election was pushing close to $50 million, which, you know, absolutely obliterates the previous record, which was something like $15
million. Yeah. Let's go ahead and start there, James. We've got a new Supreme Court justice starting in August.
Yeah. Janet Protasiewicz beat the former Justice Daniel Kelly by actually a rather large margin. So it was a decisive election.
And, you know, just kind of thinking about high level, what this means for the court. My initial thought is we're going to get a lot of, you know, this past term's been a little bit slower paced. We haven't had as many high profile cases that we've been covering.
Yeah. And that's about to change probably.
I think that'll change a bit. I think there'll be quite a few cases in the news in the coming years.
Yeah. There was certainly a lot of publicity around this election, a lot of interest. I mean, the turnout was I didn't look at how this shattered records, but I'm not aware of any Supreme Court election in this state that came close to the over 1.8 million turnout.
Without a presidential on the ballot.
Yeah. I mean, that's getting close to gubernatorial numbers, which is just crazy to think about.
Yeah.
So really high turnout election. And also there was a separate court election for District 1, which covers Milwaukee, the District 1 Court of Appeals, and the current chief judge of the Court of Appeals, Judge Brash, lost his reelection attempt.
Yeah, he lost to a union attorney?
I believe so.
A labor law attorney named Sarah Geenan, who will be taking over in District 1 in August, which means the Supreme Court at this point will have to appoint a new chief judge for the Court of Appeals.
Yeah. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. The makeup of the Court of Appeals has changed a little bit, at least in District 1, and the makeup of the Supreme Court is going to change in August as well. So we've got a little bit of time before that takes effect, but it's something to certainly watch.
Well, one thing that won't be changing going forward is who the Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court is. I guess the justices got together last month and decided that... Chief Justice Ziegler would be continuing for another 2 years as chief. Due to how the Constitution was amended a few years back, the Chief Justice's term begins and ends on May 1st. So they've already held the election at beginning, you know, for May 1st, for the term that begins on May 1st of the coming year. Chief Justice Ziegler will continue to serve as chief, which creates an interesting phenomenon. Beginning in August, the court will be controlled by, in the traditional sense, more liberal justices. But the chief justice, chosen by the members of the court, will be someone from the more traditionally conservative block. So for nearly 2 years, most likely, that will be the situation. You'll have a liberal majority, but a conservative chief justice.
Yeah. And that's not, you know, I guess in the grand scheme of things, that's not too odd. The previous system in Wisconsin was to just have your chief justice be the most senior member of the court. And so regardless of the ideological makeup of the court or perceived, a lot of times it's a perceived ideological makeup of the court, you know, your chief justice may or may not be aligned with the majority, but yeah, at least since the constitutional amendment, you know, it's more or less followed ideological lines. You know, if the there was a conservative majority, you would have a conservative chief justice. So you're right. That's going to I don't know if it'll create an interesting dynamic or not, but it's something to keep an eye on.
We're not going to spend too much on this, but look ahead a couple of years, 2025, probably means we end up with a new chief justice, perhaps.
Yeah, and because of the way the terms are, that chief justice will be selected by the current, the then current makeup of the court, which would be included future Justice Janet Protasiewicz. And, regardless of whether Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will be up for re-election in 2025.
Yeah.
And so regardless of the outcome of that election, you know, it will be selected by a majority of justices that are perceived to be on the more liberal side of things.
Which I think means, in all likelihood, not to, project out too far here, but quite likely the next Chief Justice is either going to be Ann Walsh Bradley or Rebecca Dallet.
Yeah, it's I guess we'll stay tuned for that.
Yeah. All right, that is all the more election coverage we're going to do for
yep,
this
you guys
podcast
are all probably
episode.
Tired of hearing about it.
On to actual law type stuff. James, you want to take us into a Court of Appeals case, just kind of as a general update on things happening in the court system?
Sure. So the Wisconsin Court of Appeals District 4 just decided Wisconsin State Journal v. Blazell, which is a public records case. It's a win for journalists who are in favor of a more robust public records law. District 4 awarded attorney's fees to the news organizations that had requested the records. The records related to a sexual harassment complaint against a state legislator. The legislature originally withheld the records entirely, and then they produced them with redactions. So there's kind of two separate issues. There's the, was the original withholding entirely correct? And are you entitled to fees for that? And then are the redactions appropriate under the law? So what's interesting here is less the, that part of it, but just last year, the Wisconsin Supreme Court decided Friends of Frame Park, which is another public records case. And, Caleb, you talked a little bit about how, there's a potential mootness issue here.
Yeah. So I found this Court of Appeals case interesting because, so last year when the Supreme Court decided Friends of Frame Park, what they said is, to get attorney's fees under the public records law, you have to achieve some, quote, judicially sanctioned change in the legal relationship between the requesting party and the records custodian. And the court explicitly held for another day, they stayed for another day, whether after a records custodian, suppose you have a custodian who initially withholds records, but then there's a suit, and then after the suit starts, the custodian turns over the records. Can the court then determine, well, you held on to the records too long, therefore, I'm going to hold that you broke the law, and that's a judicially sanctioned change in the party's legal relationship? Or is that, moot, and you can't make that determination, and therefore you can't get fees?
Yeah, and the reason why we're highlighting this is not just because it implicates a recent Wisconsin Supreme Court decision. It's because this is a likely case to go up to the Supreme Court. We'll see if there's a petition for review filed. I don't know if you know that or not at this point.
I haven't seen one yet, but I have little doubt this will go up.
Because it directly raises the question that Friends of Frame Park left for another day. Yeah. With that first request, which was completely denied by the record holder. And, can they get their attorney fees for that, even though that was subsequently disclosed?
Yeah. And what makes this really interesting is, so the Frame Park was a 4-3 decision, and the three justices in dissent were Kurofsky, Ann Walsh Bradley, and Dallet. So it stands to reason, add Protasiewicz to the mix, they might be look. They might take the case, and it'll be one of the first chances we get to see how the court handles stare decisis.
Yeah. Are they going to flip the script? Like, assuming Judge then Justice Protasiewicz agrees with, you know, her more liberal colleagues on that.
Yeah. So it's an interesting one to keep an eye on. And I'm sure we'll have more to say about it down the line.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on it. Caleb, there was also a petition of bypass that was granted that we want to talk about, right?
Yes. So we got one case that the Supreme Court took up, added to its docket on the civil front. And it's actually a family law case. It's called AMB v. Circuit Court of Ashland County. And as I was digging into this, it looks like a lot of the briefing has been filed under seal because it's not available on the court's website. So I'm not intimately familiar with what's going on here. But the issue sounds fascinating. So there's a statute in Wisconsin that says, from what I gather, you cannot adopt a child as a couple unless you are married. And this couple is bringing a constitutional challenge to this statute, saying that it's unconstitutional under Article 1, Section 1 of the Wisconsin Constitution and under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. This is very kind of cutting edge constitutional law, if you will.
Yep.
It's got a state constitutional issue, a federal constitutional issue.
And a new ideological makeup of the court.
Yep. And there's no way that this will be heard this term. It's going to definitely end up being a next term thing. So it'll be another case to watch with how the new court is going to.
Yeah, it kind of goes with your prediction that there's going to be a lot more kind of high profile cases.
Yeah,
probably.
Yep.
So this will be one to watch as well. So we've also had, moving on to the decided cases, we have three cases that have been decided. There's actually an additional two civil cases that were decided before we recorded, but we're going to save those for next episode. But Caleb, do you want to talk about Casanova v. Polsky?
Sure. And I don't think we're going to spend too long on this one because the bottom line here is that secured mortgages have priority over unsecured debts. You know, you learn that in law school in a secured transactions course or a real estate course or anything like that. In this case, you had, there was a senior living facility in southeastern Wisconsin. When the senior living facility was built, there was a group of investors and they took out mortgages and they had liens on the property because of that. Now, the residents who moved into the facility, they paid what were called entrance fees, and they were tens of thousands of dollars in a lot of instances that were paid upfront to the senior living facility. And my understanding is they functioned a little like security deposits and that the residents would get them back when they moved out. Senior living facility runs out of money, files for bankruptcy. And now we have a fight between the original investors who have the mortgage lien and the residents who haven't been able to get their entrance fees back. There are some arguments based on some information that was in documents presented at closing for the financing of the senior living facility, suggesting that maybe these entrance fees might have priority over a first mortgage lien. But the court took a look at that in a unanimous decision by Justice Rebecca Bradley said, no, you know, we've got a statute here that says you have to pay out a debtor's funds in this order. And secured liens come first over unsecured debts.
Yeah, and a rather unsurprising conclusion and a rather unsurprising 7-0.
Yes, although it was a reverse.
Yeah.
There was the Court of Appeals had looked at a case called M&I v. Episcopal Homes and come out the other way. But the Supreme Court said that case was distinguishable, and it probably was.
Yeah.
So, James, you want to take us on to the next one?
Milwaukee Police Supervisors Organization v. City of Milwaukee. Despite the name, the police supervisors are no longer part of this action. It really relates to the firefighters. And I won't spend a lot of time on this. This is really just a matter of interpreting the collective bargaining agreement between the city and the firefighters. And as well as, you know, the applicable ordinances. So it's just, what does the text say? And really, so what this case revolves around is certain disability and retirement benefits that are paid out to firefighters who are either injured or who are unable to continue working. And the amount that they receive is based on the current annual salary for the position they occupied. And really, the very, very narrow question is whether or not there is a pension benefit payment that, or a pension reimbursement payment, I forget the exact name of it, is included in the annual salary. And so the way that that works is, when you're active and you're working, you're required to pay, I think, 7% into the retirement system. And you don't just pay that in. Actually, if you're paying that in, you get a reimbursement payment of five or so percent coming back. And so you're receiving your salary plus the, that little five and change percent amount back. So you're not paying the full 7%. You're getting reimbursed partially for that. And prior to, I think, 2011, the city of Milwaukee had characterized that pension reimbursement payment as part of your annual salary, and then they stopped doing that. And so it's really just about, are we going to include that amount in the total amount that we then calculate your disability benefits off of? So kind of dry stuff. It's very interesting to the people that are involved in it. It means something to them, but it's a very dry kind of statutory interpretation stuff. All right, so there's not really a lot more to say about this decision. It was another unanimous Justice Rebecca Bradley opinion, a nice tight 20 pages. Not too much drama there. You know, when I read the specific language, which I'm not going to get into, it made a lot of sense.
Yeah,
the decision. It's like, you know, this is part of your annual salary. That's how we're going to calculate the benefits. At the end of the day, the dollar amount isn't really that big a difference.
Yeah, I think Justice Bradley did a nice job with this one. And I don't know that it moves the law much one way or the other, because it's pretty fact specific, but it's a good decision nonetheless.
All right. And our third decision is a lot more controversial. There are multiple opinions in this one. It's Secura Supreme Insurance Company versus the estate of Daniel Keith Huck.
James, I think this might be, correct me if I'm wrong, is this the first case that the courts decided that we actually made predictions on?
I think so.
I think it is. I think we're right.
Yeah, I think we are. We can get some kind of like a happy music there, from our marketing coordinator. That would probably be warranted here. So let's talk about this case a little bit. The issue is kind of interesting here. It's about a reducing clause in an insurance policy. So what a reducing clause is in the context of underinsured motorist coverage is, you know, you purchase your underinsured motorist coverage, and it covers you in the event that you have an accident with somebody and they're at fault and they have insufficient insurance to cover it. So your insurance company promises, in this case, I think the limits were $250,000. They promise to pay you for those damages that should have been paid by the other motorist, right? That's underinsured motorist coverage. And that is regulated by statute. What the statute does allow you to do is have a reducing clause, which says, well, we get to reduce our payout or our limits by the amounts that you received from either the tortfeasor or, as relevant here, amounts paid or payable under your workers' compensation insurance. And so here you had, you know, the insured gets into an accident, the other driver's at fault, the insured's workers' compensation pays out an amount of money. I believe it was $30,000. And then subsequently, the tortfeasor, the person at fault for the accident, pays out $25,000. And pursuant to the language of the workers' compensation policy that paid money, the insured was required to pay back part of the money that the insured received from the workers' compensation insurance. And so the question is, what amounts were paid or payable under the workers' compensation? And Secura argued that it was the first amount that was paid, the full $25,000, and it gets to take full advantage of that $25,000. And the insured says, well, I didn't really get paid that because I had to pay it back.
Yeah.
And I'm going to jump around. I'm not going to start with the lead. I'm not going to start with the lead opinion or the beginning of the case, because I think that there is a line from the concurrence that sums up
real everything quick, here. Just to make sure that I'm, and I think, I know we discussed this case in the past, but just to make sure I'm grasping the sequence of events here. The insured in a car accident passes away. The workers' compensation carrier pays something like $36,000, somewhere ballpark around there.
Yeah.
To the estate.
To the estate, yes.
The tortfeasor then pays the estate some amount of money. I don't remember how much, but they have to give some, but then they have to reimburse the workers' compensation carrier.
That's correct.
And it's just, how much did the work, how much money were you, was paid or payable?
Yep.
From the workers' compensation carrier, the original amount that was paid or the amount after that reimbursement happened? Is that kind of,
yeah, that's it. You know, you have the motorist, strikes the insured, and that motorist, the tortfeasor, was insured for $25,000. And as part of a settlement, that full amount, that $25,000, was paid into the estate of the insured. And then the workers' compensation, carrier required the estate to repay something in the realm of $9,000, back in, because the workers' compensation policy has a somewhat of a reducing clause in it, right? You know, you get less benefits if you get, you know, some payment from the tortfeasor. So that's what's going on here.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess the under insurance policy says you're going to get, here was like what, $250,000.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So basically they're saying, look, if you get something from someone else, that's going to count against the $250,000.
That's correct. That's what a reducing clause does.
Okay.
And so the Secura is arguing that, well, you got paid $25,000 from the workers' comp carrier, so we get to reduce our limits by $25,000.
It's like $36,000, I think. They agreed to reduce by $25,000.
Yeah, sorry, I'm getting the numbers mixed up. Yeah, it was $36,000. It's like, well, you got that. We get to reduce it by that full amount.
Yep.
And the estate's argument back, the successor to the insured, is that, well, yeah, we didn't really get paid that because we had to pay it right back because we also received the $25,000 from the policy, from the other policy. And so it's just a question of what is the amount that is paid under the workers' comp policy? Is it the 36 or is it the, you know, 27?
Yeah. Okay.
Right. And I'm going to jump straight to the concurrence. And the reason I'm going to jump straight to the concurrence is I think there's a very concise summary of what's going on here. Justice Dallet, writing for a 4-justice concurrence. So this is actually binding on this is the binding decision here. It says, if I buy an $8 sandwich and hand the cashier a $10 bill and she hands me my sandwich and $2 in change, how much was she paid for the sandwich? $8, of course. But according to Secura, that isn't so clear. It's like, I think that's really a good summary of what Secura is arguing here, is they're making what I thought was a kind of a cute argument based on, it is somewhat rooted in the text. It's a very, very literal reading of the text, but an argument that the estate was actually paid the full amount of the workers' comp policy rather than the amount less what they had to reimburse the workers' comp policy for.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the summary there.
It is interesting. So, and I think this metaphor is perfectly apt. But what you noted, it was written by Justice Dallet, joined by a majority of the court, and yet it has the title of a concurrence. That's a curious development.
Yeah. Now the court is there is a majority, 6-1, on the basic holding that the reducing clause only applies to the amounts, the net amount that you receive from the workers' comp, right? You don't get mm-hmm. to deduct the full 36. So it's like paragraphs 1 and 2, 4 through 16 and like 29 or something of the, lead opinion, which was drafted by Justice Rogensack, that commands 6 justices. Where there's a departure is in the, Justice Rogensack's lead opinion wanted to address the reducing statute itself in a bunch of textual arguments. And so the concurrence, which is the, you know, majority opinion, majority rationale.
Sure. Yeah, it elaborates on the majority rationale, restates the majority rationale joined by the majority.
Yeah.
But it's not in a majority opinion, and I guess I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah, I would read it as binding because it commanded four justices. I mean, that's maybe I'm thinking about this too simply. But, you know, really, Rogin-Sack's opinion wanted to go a little bit further and address more than what the styled concurrence wanted to address. And then you had a quite a lengthy dissent by Justice Rebecca Bradley. It's actually longer than both the lead opinion and the concurrence combined, which was interesting. But that dissent focused on a very literal reading of the text, tracked Sakura's argument pretty well. But ultimately, the rest of the court didn't agree with it.
So one thing, this kind of as we were preparing this case and reading through it, one thing, there's a line that came to mind from a lecture I had seen once on legal writing by Brian O'Neill, who was a the late Brian O'Neill, who was a litigator at Fagry in the Twin Cities, I believe. And he, one of his main points that he drove home in this lecture was, it is just essential that your argument is, quote, in the nature of things. And what I took from that is your argument has to have some intuitive appeal. It has to make sense to a natural human. It has to be in the nature of things. And I think the difficulty here that most of the court had with Sakura's argument and that I had with Sakura's argument is, look, you took out an underinsured insurance policy for $250,000. But because of some quirk, you're only going to get, $239,000. And it's because you had this money in your hand briefly, but you had to give it back. And that just doesn't quite seem in the nature of things.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you and I had an interesting conversation, I think. I'm wondering, other than the very, the kind of obvious and perhaps somewhat cynical, oh, the insurance company just doesn't want to pay the money. Is there something about this? Is there an in the nature of things aspect to Sakura's argument that I'm missing? And I'd be interested to talk to one of the attorneys who worked on the case and see what they had to say, because I'm just not seeing it. And I do a lot of work for insurance companies, and a lot of times arguments are not necessarily intuitive. You have to break them down, but there is an in the nature of things argument for the insurer's position. You know, they're not just trying to avoid paying money that, they promise to pay. There's an actual equitable argument. There's some fundamental unfairness, but these policies are often very complex, and the whole insurer-insured relationship is, again, not a very intuitive thing to begin with. There's some logic to the insurer's position. This is one of the times where I look at the insurer's position and I struggle to see the intuitive appeal of it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the one thing I'll say, you just look at the text. And if you're just in a vacuum examining it, I can see how you can get to either spot.
Yeah.
You can say, look, you were paid $36,000, even though you eventually gave some of that money back. But then when you look at this in the broader context, which is what you're supposed to do with statutory interpretation, you're supposed to take, these words, they don't exist in a vacuum. They're within a particular context. Give them meaning, based on that context. And here, I just don't see how they could have come out any other way. James, real quick, while we're still on this case, a couple things I noticed, want to get your thoughts on. One's paragraph 29.
Oh, that's very specific.
Of the majority, yeah. So this is in the conclusion, and it's one of the handful of paragraphs that was joined by six members of the court. And it says, the policy, the UIM policy, that is, also required the estate to exhaust any other bodily injury liability bonds or policies and to receive payment from them before Sakura would pay UIM benefits. So that's interesting, and it could have some ramifications in insurance law generally. If you can insist that the insured go seek payment from any other source before the UIM insurer has to pay, that could have some implications for when the UIM's obligation is triggered.
I don't know. I don't do a ton of UIM work, so I don't know if this is a change or if this is just something that's unremarkable, or if it's a, you know, every once in a while you get like a casual remark in a case that's actually kind of it's kind of a big deal and the court doesn't realize it at the time.
I don't know. I don't know. It jumped out at me that there's kind of this order of operations. So I wanted to comment on it.
Yeah, I guess if that sort of circles back to what I was saying, that insurance policies are not intuitive documents. They're very technical. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes when you start breaking down how they work, it's much more complicated than you think.
Yeah, yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to highlight is in the dissent. And so in paragraph 42, and this kind of just goes to the judicial philosophy thing, and I think it's a dispute that's been happening maybe between Justice Rebecca Bradley and the rest of the court. But she says, critiquing the majority lead opinion for analyzing some arguments that weren't fully presented by the parties, she says, quote, "While this court has near absolute discretion to deviate from the parties' arguments, and often does given its law development function, the majority lead opinion does not exercise discretion because it does not explain its departure from the party presentation principle." So this is interesting. Justice Rebecca Bradley says, look, we are the court of last resort. We are not bound to parties' arguments.
We have near absolute discretion.
Near absolute discretion, which I think at least several of the probably a majority of the court would disagree with. They would, you know, view themselves somewhat bound by party arguments. But you know, she says we've got this broad discretion, but then she constrains it in this interesting way where she says, even though we have this broad discretion, we have to exercise discretion by explaining why we're departing from party presentation principles.
And the party presentation principle is just, it's a general rule of that, that courts don't like addressing things that the parties didn't brief. And the idea behind that is, you know, you want the benefit of the adversarial briefing, both sides sort of teasing out the strengths and weaknesses of the arguments before you weigh in on an issue. And that's a fairly well-established prudential principle in appellate litigation. And it's been the source of a bit of a disagreement in recent years.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess to some extent, I think even Justice Bradley would say there are certain things you can't do absent party presentation. For example, on review, you cannot decide that the plaintiff has a breach of contract claim when all they brought was a tort claim. You know, I think there's probably some bounds that she would recognize. Although, I mean, in some cases we've seen some appetite to decide constitutional questions that weren't briefed either. So maybe I'm wrong on that. This was a very bold statement, and I wanted to flag it because I think it's a minority view, but it's a crisp articulation of, you know, what one justice thinks on this. And I'm curious to watch it develop and how the kind of new court we'll see next term will handle issues like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely an interesting question. So now we're moving on to the one case that's up for review, up for argument in April. And we're asking somewhat the question of how much is 26 years of your life worth? Caleb, you want to take this one?
Sure. So the one civil case the court's reviewing is Derek Sanders versus the Wisconsin Claims Board. And basically what happened here is in 1993, Derek Sanders was convicted of first-degree intentional homicide as an accessory to the crime, basically. And he was sentenced to life in prison. Fast forward 26 years, he wins a post-conviction motion and his conviction gets set aside, and then the district attorney says, we're not going to re-prosecute. So at that point, it was, you know, more or less determined that he had been wrongfully convicted 26 years earlier and spent 26 years of his life in prison wrongfully. Now, in Wisconsin, there is a statute, section 775.05, that compensates people who are incarcerated wrongfully. And what it says is the claims board, which is a government agency, more or less, is empowered to compensate the wrongfully incarcerated person at an amount not to exceed $25,000 and at a rate of compensation not greater than $5,000 per year of the imprisonment. And then there's an additional provision which goes on to say that if the claims board finds that the amount that it can award, that $25,000, is insufficient, they can submit a report to the legislature asking the legislature to appropriate money to the individual to properly compensate them.
And Caleb, that presumptive $25,000 limit is one of, if not the lowest limits in the country.
It is, yeah. So the history behind this is kind of interesting. And the Sanders attorney goes into this in his brief. Wisconsin was actually the first state to have one of these laws to compensate people for wrongful convictions. But they haven't updated it all that recently, I think.
I think the original statute was 1913 or something.
Yep. And at that point, it might have been $5,000. So they've upped the number since then. But of the 30-some states that have these statutes, I think we're lowest or second lowest.
I think I kind of derailed you. What happened with the petition here?
Sure. So Mr. Sanders, he filed a petition with the claims board asking for over $5 million. And the claims board came back and said, you are awarded $25,000. But what they didn't do is they didn't say anything about filing a report to the legislature about whether he should get more money. So it was
they didn't mention his request for an amount beyond the $25,000 really at all.
Right, yeah. So it's just $25,000. Here you go. Send you on your merry way.
Is that amount taxable? Like, can he get that? Does he get the full $25,000?
Ooh, I'm not sure if the... So our producer extraordinaire, Kylie, just asked an interesting question that I'm not sure if the mic picked up, but she asked if this $25,000 is taxable, which is interesting. James, do you know?
I don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head, but we do have tax people here. So let me go grab our MTFN tax expert or one of them, Mackenzie Tibbetts, and see what she has to say.
We'll be right back.
All right, so we're back here with Mackenzie Tibbetts, one of our tax lawyers here. Hi, Mackenzie.
Hi, James.
So the question is, if you get awarded compensation for being wrongfully incarcerated, do you get taxed on that amount that you receive from the government?
So interestingly, there is this thing called the wrongful incarceration exclusion, where basically what it does is if someone is wrongfully incarcerated, let's say, and they at some point there's a determination of innocence, and then they later receive some sort of compensation related to that, it is possible that it could be excluded from their income and thereby be tax-free. It is a little bit more technical than that, but that's kind of just the gist of it. So it's possible that it could be tax-free.
So it is possible. So what you're saying is if he gets paid $25,000, if that's the only amount he gets, or if the amount is increased as a result of this case or as a direct or indirect result of this case, he might actually be able to go home with the full amount and not, like let's say he got his $5 million. He's not, netting, $2.5 million because the rest goes to the government.
Right. Like I said, it's a little bit more technical, but it is definitely possible that it could be tax-free.
Something tells me this is going to be cold comfort. But I mean, good news for Mr. Sanders, but probably some cold comfort.
Yeah, and unless the amount is increased. $25,000 for 26 years seems, almost insulting.
It's a little bit paltry, yeah.
Well, thanks a lot for your tax expertise, Mackenzie.
You're very welcome.
So now that we've got the tax question somewhat answered.
And just to be clear for our listeners, that is not an issue here.
No. The taxability of whatever he receives from the state of Wisconsin is not an issue. It's just something that our producer raised. So kind of moving on, what's going on in the challenge here?
Right. So it's weird in that on appeal, Sanders isn't actually asking that the court increase his compensation from $25,000 up to the $5 million plus that he actually seeks. He's asking that the court send it back to the claims board to exercise its discretion and decide whether to send a report to the legislature, urging the legislature to ask for more money.
Yeah, and I think you've highlighted something important. There's really, or kind of raised something that's kind of important. There are two aspects to his challenge here. There's the issue of whether or not the claims board exercised its discretion, because the claims board determines whether or not the amount of compensation is adequate to compensate the wrongfully incarcerated. And his argument is that there's just no determination. And there's some case law out there that talks about how if you as a body, like a claims board, are tasked with exercising discretion and you don't explain your decision, that's an erroneous exercise of discretion. You've got to go back and actually explain your reasons. And so that's part one.
Well, interesting. That didn't seem to come up in briefing too much. It was more...
Well, yeah. And I think the reason it didn't come up in briefing primarily is because that's almost a settled issue, is whether or not the claims board has to exercise discretion, assuming it is tasked with exercising discretion. So I think that case law is pretty clear. But the reason I raise that is because there might be some appetite at the court, I don't know, to reassess, you know, what kind of or how much of an explanation a body needs to give in order to properly exercise discretion. But you're right, this is primarily presented by the briefing, which is quite good, by the way, as a question of statutory interpretation and whether or not the statute requires the claims board to actually make a determination that compensation is adequate. So that's sort of where the parties hinge their arguments.
Right. And so I guess I was kind of surprised as I was going through the briefing just how driven by statutory interpretation it is. Now, if you look at this law, section 775.05, sub 4 talks about what the claims board has to do. And kind of the relevant parts of it say, first, the claims board shall find the amount which will equitably compensate the petitioner not to exceed $25,000. And then it goes on to say in a separate sentence, if the claims board finds that the amount it is able to award is not an adequate compensation, it shall submit a report specifying the amount which it considers adequate to the legislature. And what the state is arguing here, the claims board is arguing, is that that second sentence is entirely conditional. This is an if and only if the claims board...
It's totally optional. You don't have to determine whether or not compensation was adequate.
Right. Or you don't have to determine if compensation above $25,000 was inadequate.
Yeah, that's a little bit more fair reading of it. You're so, right. They're reading those two sentences as having nothing to do with each other.
Or very little to do with it. It's like they're reading it as saying, if the legislature so chooses, or not the legislature, the claims board so chooses, it has the option of going ahead and presenting this option to the legislature, but it doesn't have to, or it doesn't even have to really decide whether it wants to do that. Whereas as I understand Sanders' argument, or the argument his attorney is making, is that the statute requires the claims board to first figure out the amount of compensation that's warranted, and that amount could exceed $25,000. It could be this guy was in prison for 26 years. We think, therefore, he's entitled to $5 million or whatever. And then in the next step, to award the $25,000 that the statute provides. And then if the number that they had initially come to is bigger than $25,000, then they have to go ahead and file the report.
Yeah, and I think Sanders has the better argument here from a textual standpoint. I'm sure you'll talk about the history in a minute too, but just, you know, my first read of the statute and how this sets up the claims board and the procedure for getting compensation, it all looks mandatory. It's like sub one, the claims board shall hear petitions for compensation. Sub two governs all these things that the claims board has to do. And then after hearing on the evidence, the claims board shall find either that the evidence is clear that that there's a wrongful conviction or it's not. If the claims board finds that the petitioner was innocent, then the claims board shall find the amount which will equitably compensate the petitioner. And then finally, the sentence here, if the claims board finds that the amount it is able to award is not adequate compensation, it shall submit a report specifying the amount which it considers adequate. And the counter argument from just looking at the text, absent the history, which I'm sure you'll go into in a minute, it's not an implausible argument, but I still think Sanders has the better argument just looking at the text, because it looks like the legislature has tasked the claims board with, you make a determination on equitable compensation, you have a kind of presumptive limit of 25K. If it gets beyond that, then you have to write a report to us and tell us why you think more is appropriate. But, you know, the claims board here is trying to say, well, we don't really have to determine if amounts beyond 25,000 are necessary, or if 25,000 is enough to compensate you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I looked at this the first time I read it, and it was not, you know, near as clear cut to me. It looked like the text is kind of confusing. It says the claims board will find the amount which will equitably compensate the petitioner not to exceed $25,000. That could be read as narrowing the claims board's discretion on to what extent it can compensate the petitioner, like your scope of discretion, or narrowing the amount it can find as being adequate, right? There's an argument there. I see the appeal to it. Now, where I ultimately ended up thinking that argument is not correct is looking at the statutory history, and you mentioned this. What the parties did is they went back in briefing, and they looked at when this law was enacted in 1913. And when it was enacted, it was worded a little differently. It
said, very, very close.
It said, the board shall proceed to find the amount which will compensate the petitioner for his wrongful imprisonment, period. And then it said, such board may award a compensation to the petitioner so found innocent of not to exceed $5,000 in any case. So it very clearly in the original 1913 law treats this as a two-step process. First, you find the amount, then you award up to $5,000, and then it goes on to say you can make a report.
Yeah, and the board concedes that if this were brought under the 1913 statute, that it would be required to make that determination.
Yes. So what's interesting, there was a change to the law in 1935, and this is the sort of statutory interpretation that I love. I love the statutory history stuff. So in 1935, the legislature changes the law to say the commission shall find the amount which will compensate him for his wrongful imprisonment, but not to exceed $5,000. And this is really where what the state's hanging its hat on. They're saying, look, in 1935, the legislature intentionally changed the law to limit the discretion of the claims board, or whatever, it was a commission at the time, to find adequate compensation only up to this amount, and not requiring it to conclude that adequate compensation could be more. So that, you know, that's a compelling argument. One of our canons of interpretation is that when the words of the statute changes, that means the legislature intended to change the meaning.
I'm sensing a pretty big however coming here.
Exactly. However, one of my favorite statutes is WSSTAT section 990.001(7).
Oh, gosh.
Which says a revised statute is to be understood in the same sense as the original, unless the change in language indicates a different meaning so clearly as to preclude judicial construction. If the revision bill contains a note which says that the meaning of the statute to which the note relates is not changed by the revision, the note is indicative of legislative intent. So, and Chapter 990 of the statutes is kind of the statutorily enacted interpretive guide.
And let me guess, there's a note here.
There is a note here, and Mr. Sanders talks about it in his brief. The 1935 law was a kind of a reviser's bill. It was designed to clarify, clean up the statutes. And it specifically said, there was a note in it which said, this law or this bill does not change the meaning of the provisions it touches unless we have a note saying that we're intending to change the meaning. There was no note on this section. So going back to 990.001(7), the revisor's bill contains a note saying that it doesn't change the meaning unless there's a note specifically saying so. Here there's no note. So it seems like a straight application of the statutory rule governing the interpretation of statutory changes says that the 1913 and 1935 laws mean the same thing.
Yeah.
And that supports Sanders' argument.
Yeah. And I would agree with you there 100%. And I just would reiterate how good the briefing was here, because all of this stuff was laid out very clearly. There was very tight writing, a lot of use of hypotheticals of how like language would apply. I mean, the English language can sometimes be a bit of an amorphous construction, and you can make things clear by teasing it out with examples. And so I guess if you're an appellate practitioner, you should probably read the briefing here, because it's written by people who knew what they were doing.
Yeah, they were very, very good. And statutory interpretation, it's tough to write a compelling brief.
Yeah.
It's a little more easy when you're dealing with equitable doctrines, or, you know, you have interesting facts. And the facts here are certainly interesting and quite sad. But when you're just diving into, we think this clause of this sentence should relate to this clause of this other sentence in this way, it's really easy to become very dry in your writing.
Yeah.
And yeah, the attorneys here just did very nice work.
So I guess it's prediction time on this.
I mean, even I think on this case, there's no, so the Court of Appeals, we should mention, held that the claims board had not properly exercised its discretion.
Yeah.
And I don't see any way that you get 4 votes to reverse that determination.
Yeah, I think it's an affirm. I think that the court will agree with Sanders' statutory interpretation. And then to sort of the second issue that's not argued as much, did the claims board exercise discretion? I think that's going to be a reverse and send it back down so the claims board can exercise its discretion. Although one additional thing that I thought of is like, so let's say that the board's discretion is at issue. I think even if it exercised it, if it came and argued that it made a discretionary determination that $25,000 is enough to accommodate you for 26 years in prison, I think that's so facially absurd as to constitute an erroneous exercise of discretion.
I mean, that's a tougher sell. I know harmless error came up in briefing, and I know the Court of Appeals dissent discussed harmless error and said, look, even if we send it back, the claims board's not going to do anything differently necessarily. What's weird is the remedy. The remedy isn't give this guy more money. The remedy is the claims board has to exercise discretion and decide whether to write a report to the legislature. And then the legislature can pass a bill deciding whether to appropriate funds. This guy, Mr. Sanders, can go to the legislature no matter what and ask the legislature to appropriate money to him. It's just whether he gets this little bit of assistance from the claims board in the form of a report.
Well, this is certainly helping the publicity for any attempt to request more money from the legislature.
That's true.
And I mean, I don't know, if I was the claims board and this gets sent back down to me, I would feel at least some pressure to thoughtfully consider the request for $5 million. So if it goes back down, I suspect there's going to be a report to the legislature recommending at least some additional compensation.
I don't want to speculate as to what the claims board will do, but the claims board has exercised this power in the past. I know Sanders' attorney references a few times where the claims board has recommended that the legislature, appropriate, I think in some cases, millions of dollars.
Yeah, that was my recollection from the briefing.
Yeah. Whatever the Supreme Court does here, this case will not be over. It'll have at least...
Correct.
Well, I guess if they reverse here.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, you're right.
That would be the Court of Appeals. If they reverse and say, nope, what the claims board did is fine, it'll be over. But if they send it back, the claims board will decide what to do, and then the legislature will decide what to do. So very, very interesting case. A little bit outside of our... maybe commercial law bailiwick, but great civil case, but a very interesting civil case nonetheless.
Absolutely.
All right, James, I think we've gotten through everything else that we were going to discuss this month, unless I'm missing anything.
Nah, that's everything.
All right, well, let's go ahead and wrap it up there. There was a lot of interesting stuff this month. I mean, we've got a few decisions. There's already a couple decisions that have come out for April, so we'll take a look at those next month. And, you know, many thanks to the firm for getting us this new recording equipment. And
absolutely.
And as always, to our stalwart producer for
Kylie,
putting up with us and you know, setting up all the equipment and turning this into a hopefully presentable production. taking off the rough edges for James and I a little bit.
Absolutely.
All right. I think that's about it. Until next month, I'm Caleb Gerbitz.
And I'm James Cisnowski.
Thank you for listening to this MTFN BizCast. For more information, please visit our website, mtfn.com. There you can access other podcast episodes, articles, and the contact information for our attorneys. To keep up to date with Meisner, Tierney, Fisher & Nichols, you can also follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.